You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Michael Cunningham's latest novel, By Nightfall, Peter and Rebecca Harris are a 40-something couple living in Soho. They've been married for nearly 22 years, and they have settled into what is by all means a comfortable life together. However, things begin changing when Rebecca's younger brother, a recovering drug addict who's just returned from a trip to Japan, comes to stay with them. By Nightfall is Mr. Cunningham's sixth book. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we're very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hi.
Hey, I'm very pleased to be here.
And it is the novel, not the op-ed piece, that brought you here today, right?
Oh, no, I thought it was the op-ed piece. What am I doing here then?
This is the
novel.
First,
what novel?
This is the first novel you've written since 2005 Specimen Days.
Mm-hmm,
have you been working on it all that time?
Intermittently. I have been working on it steadily, but let's just say it. I've also gone to Hollywood. Yes, I am no less a whore than many of my novelist brothers.
I would
sisters.
Have said gun for hire.
Gun for hire. Yeah, this gun's for hire.
But you've also been teaching over the years at Brooklyn College, Columbia, now part-time at Yale.
Yeah, yeah.
You probably could live off the proceeds of your writing. So is there something that you would miss if you stopped teaching?
Oh, I would miss it terribly. I don't really teach for the money. I get to sit in a seminar room 2 days a week now at Yale and talk to brilliant young people about some of the questions that I don't talk to my friends about. Why do we write? Who is it for? How do we do it? And I get a tremendous amount of stimulation and inspiration from it.
Has it changed your ideas about what you're all about? I mean, why do we write? Had you ever asked yourself that question in the past? It's just something that some people feel compelled to do.
Yeah, but I think it's still a question worth asking. There are already more books in the world than anyone could possibly read.
And many of them are terrible.
And many of them are terrible, and some of them are good. But I think by the year 2010, one would be remiss in not asking oneself, do we really need a gazillionth novel? And if so, what does the gazillionth novel need to be that the others have not been?
So how does that work with this book? When did you start thinking about it?
You know, I've been thinking about it for years. It is set in the world of art and commerce, which has always been fascinating to me. Half my friends are either artists or art dealers. And one of the great things about writing a novel is you get to live vicariously in some parallel world. And I got to live periodically over the last 5 years as an art dealer.
The first line of By Nightfall is, "The mistake is coming to stay for a while." And I mentioned the op-ed piece that you wrote for the New York Times, which was about translation, but it was also about first lines.
Yeah, yeah.
When does the first line come to you?
Usually over a period of weeks or even months of effort. Joan Didion once said, once you got the first line, the rest of the novel is easy, which, of course, she didn't mean literally, but when you have that first line, when you have a sense of how you're going to tell the story, what the voice is going to be, what the rhythms of the sentences are going to be, in a certain sense, now all you have to do is spend the next 3 years attaching a novel to that line.
By that time, will you already have written quite a bit?
No.
You need that first line.
I hover around in a semi-controlled panic for however many weeks or months it takes to come up with that first line.
But so many people will write a novel in third person and then after two drafts realize that they want to go to first person instead and change things around. You're not that kind of writer.
I'm not that kind of writer. No. I work slowly and steadily and methodically, but I pretty much put down a sentence, stand on that sentence, and sort of put down the next sentence. And what I end up with is very much what I started out with.
Is this connected to the NPR writing contest in which you've judged first and last lines?
Well, everything is connected to everything, of course. But yeah, I'm doing this great fun thing with NPR whereby I am judging a short story writing contest. I provided the first and last lines of the story, and people are invited to connect them with just under 600 words worth of prose.
Mm. So the last line is also very important?
Well, last line is hugely important. Yeah, I mean, every line is, but first and last lines, my God, yeah.
Because, but you don't know the last line until you get close to it, do you?
I don't know the last line really until I've written the penultimate line. I'm very much about writing in the dark, writing intuitively, about not knowing where the book is going.
So in your article, you talked about a first line, one of the most famous ones, Call Me Ishmael.
Call Me Ishmael, that's a good one.
Why is that a good one?
You know, I think
it doesn't tell me anything about whales.
No. Though you're about to learn more about whales than you ever imagined you might want to.
And about the vomit and everything else.
Yeah, whale vomit. Who doesn't want to know about whale vomit? Read Moby Dick. I think part of what's brilliant about that first line is its sort of biblical certainty. It's assurance. Pow, pow. Call me Ishmael. And also the music of it. Call me Ishmael. Call me Bob isn't as good.
Right. And you point out that it has to work well in translation or else it undermines the book.
Yeah. Well, this is where the translator, one of the great unsung heroes of literature comes in, because of course a good translator actually rewrites your book in another language.
So what's happened with your books? Have you discovered that some of the translations are better than others? Are there translations of the hours out there that totally distort what you were attempting to do?
If there are, I prefer not to know about it. There was a moment early on when my book started to be translated when I thought I have to find someone who speaks Turkish so I can check the Turkish edition, and then I realized, no, brother friend, just let that one go. Just have a little faith and get on with your other business.
Your couple in this book, Peter and Rebecca, have a pretty good marriage.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to write about a solid marriage that is still subject to a big shake.
Would their lives without Ethan coming to stay have been as worthy of a novel, or does Ethan have to come and mess things up?
Yeah, I mean, I think somebody once said there are only two stories. There's the story of the journey, and there's a story about the arrival of a mysterious stranger. And I think without one or the other, you probably don't have much of a book.
And you told this from Peter's perspective.
I did.
So we know what Peter thinks about his wife, for example.
We know what Peter thinks about almost everything, possibly ad nauseum.
He says that he's the winner of various second prizes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's one of the things that I got from Virginia Woolf, this insistence on chronicling the lives of people who are not great heroes, who are not the winners of first prize, but who look ordinary from the outside and who, as the writer understands, and we hope the reader will understand, is actually anything but ordinary. There's no such thing as an ordinary person.
They've been together for a while, but certain very simple things still bother him or concern him. For example, there's a moment when they're spending a Sunday afternoon together in bed. They're reading the Sunday New York Times, and Peter decides to have lunch with a friend, and he's strangely concerned when Rebecca doesn't mind that he's leaving. It bothers him because Sunday is their day together.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I hope to do in this book is chronicle the uncountable little infelicities and fears, and so your wife says, "Oh, fine, bye, honey. Have a good day." And you're happy to be let go, but you also wonder why doesn't she want me to stay home?
What are Peter's thoughts about Ethan, her brother?
His thoughts about Ethan are enormously complicated, and what begins to happen over time is that he sees in Ethan what he saw in the young Rebecca. When she was new to him, when she was an idealistic, impossibly argumentative 19-year-old girl, and here she is, more or less reincarnated in the form of her younger brother.
Well, he's also young and quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Is this as much about the fluidity of sexuality as anything?
You know, all my books are to some extent about the fluidity of sexuality, but this book is really more about an essentially straight guy who finds himself drawn not to the outward particulars, but to the kind of essence of a boy when he's not attracted to boys. If it was if it were anything as simple as a gay guy finally coming out, I wouldn't have wanted to write it.
Well, that book has been written, hasn't it?
Over and over and over again. And who would I be to contribute one more book to that particular stack?
Michael Cunningham is my guest. His latest book is a novel called By Nightfall. Rebecca grew up in Virginia. Her father is a professor of linguistics. Her mother's a pediatrician. How important are those kinds of details? Could you just as easily have made the mother a lawyer and the father a professor of literature?
Oh, you could, of course you can vary some of the particulars. But what I wanted for Rebecca's family was this sense of romance, this sense that Rebecca was not only compelling in herself, but was compelling as a member of this sort of miniature country comprised of her very eccentric and compelling family.
Rebecca's mother says that Ethan must have been desperate to be born.
Because he was born 20 years after they thought they were done having children. He's wildly younger than the three sisters, who are Rebecca and two others.
Does the fact that he's recovering from drug addiction make him more or less attractive?
Well, I suppose it depends on how you feel about somebody recovering from drug addiction. I wanted a sense of tragedy about Ethan. I wanted a sense of the ephemeral about him, like any work of art, which is how Peter comes to see him as a kind of living work of art. He is endangered.
As I mentioned earlier, you wrote a fairly large, long op-ed piece, almost Frank Rich length, in which you considered the relationship of the writer and reader, and you concluded that writers should write ultimately for the reader and not for themselves, which is opposite to what many writers have told me.
Yeah. Well,
they've said, I write for myself, and then I assume that people are going to find it interesting if I found it interesting.
And I just don't think that way. And yes, every night I go home and make a big, beautiful cake and eat it all by myself. I don't see the point. I mean, I think part of what a novel is a kind of muscular, electrified, sexy confrontation between the writer and the reader.
So when you're writing, are you thinking, am I being entertaining here, or am I engaging my reader with the scene or with these insights?
Yeah, I think you don't, of course, want to pander to readers. You want to stay true to your own vision, if I can use that word with a straight face. I think of it as having a conversation. You want to engage the other person and be engaged by the other person. I mean, I think it's important to add that I not only think of my readers, I think of my readers thinking of me. I'm not writing to educate some kind of unwashed masses. I'm writing for my peers.
Does this, to some degree, come out of your writing screenplays? Because when you're writing for a film, you really do have to think about how an audience is going to react. You can't just do something that you think is really clever.
No, I was nutty this way long before I started writing screenplays.
And you, the only screenplay that I really remember is Evening, which you wrote in 2007, other than adaptations of your own work.
Well, I've written a lot of them that have not been produced.
Can you make a living writing screenplays that don't get produced?
Yes, and you would become gradually ever more translucent around the edges until finally you would disappear entirely.
You once worked as a bartender. We've talked about this in Laguna Beach.
Yeah, I did.
And at that time, did you imagine? Well, obviously, you couldn't have imagined the kind of success you had. But did you think, well, I'll be a writer and try to make a living from it one way or another?
Oh yeah, I mean, I didn't have any particular ambitions to be a bartender. I wanted to be a writer, and I write in the mornings, and so the evening occupations that I could think of were night watchman, cat burglar, and bartender. And of the three, bartender seemed the one I was best qualified for.
Michael Cunningham's latest novel is By Nightfall. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.